Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, April 29th, we discuss the Supreme Court's oral argument in Penn East Pipeline LLC versus New Jersey. My name is Evelyn Hildebrandt, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. I will introduce our moderator who's with us this afternoon. Mr. Roger Marzullo will moderate this discussion. He's a partner at Marzullo Law and an executive committee member of our Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. So be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. With that, thank you for being with us today. Roger, the floor is yours.
Well, good afternoon to all of you who are east of the Pacific Coast time zone. I'm Roger Marzullo, and I'm not the one you came to hear from. Rather, you came to hear from Paul Clement, former Solicitor General of the United States, more than 100 Supreme Court arguments under his belt, and on anybody's list, one of the top lawyers to be sought after for any major Supreme Court case that is pending and is to be argued. Paul has graciously joined us after his rather triumphal but challenging argument yesterday in Penn East Pipeline versus New Jersey, a case in which he colorfully ended by indicating that sovereign immunity is a stranger in a strange land when it comes to eminent domain. If that's cryptic for you, I think we'll get it described fairly soon. Suffice to say that the briefs and the arguments in this case ranged from the 11th Amendment and the 5th Amendment to the Supremacy Clause to Article 3 jurisdiction to the Articles of Confederation in the time of the framers and to the Natural Gas Act and the operations of a federal agency, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, and jumped back and forth from those, rather like a sailor doing a jig. To unscramble this all for us, we're going to have Paul talk about the case in which he represented Penn East Pipeline, a pipeline that has been planned to run from the Marcellus shale beds in eastern Pennsylvania over into New Jersey, and specifically focused on the attempts of Penn East to condemn certain lands and other property rights in the nature of easements, open space easements, agricultural easements, and the like, that were owned by the state of New Jersey. Those were ultimately stopped dead in their tracks by the Third Circuit when the Third Circuit accepted the position of the state of New Jersey that they were immune from suit on the ground that Penn East was a citizen of another state, Delaware, attempting to sue a state without its consent in federal court in contravention of the 11th Amendment. That's the issue that went to the Supreme Court that was argued yesterday. And with that brief reference to what was going on, because there were a lot of other things going on, needless to say, Paul, why don't you tell us a bit about the case, the issues as you saw them, and what was your reaction to the rather spirited arguments yesterday?
Well, thank you, Roger, both for the kind introduction to me, but also to the case. I think you actually did a great job of kind of situating the case and also capturing the wide range of kind of sources and issues that were discussed yesterday. As your intro suggests, there's a lot of different places that I could start in talking about this case or trying to give everyone a little bit more background. You know, I could start in, you know, 1789. I could start, you know, with the plan of the convention. I could start in 1947 with the critical amendments to the Natural Gas Act. But I think instead I'll start in 2015 before FERC, when my client Penn East kind of made an application for a pipeline. That kicks off a relatively elaborate process before FERC, where there's a initial proposal for the pipeline route, and then all of the potentially affected property owners are notified, you know, pursuant to the FERC proceedings. They have rights to participate, and those rights to participate are include state governments and are by no means limited to the state governments. The state governments, when they can participate in that process, can essentially assert their rights as property owners to the extent that the pipeline route is going to cross lands in which they hold some kind of interest. But they also get to participate more as sovereigns in the sense of raising concerns about the effect of the pipeline on a broad range of state interests, everything from environmental considerations to other considerations of policy and the like. That process took place before FERC, and it ultimately produced a what is kind of technically in FERC speak called a certificate. I think it's a certificate of public interest and convenience or something along those lines. Probably the most important thing about the certificate for purposes of the case before the Supreme Court is to just understand that that certificate is specific as to the route. And so when FERC approves a certificate for a particular pipeline, it approves a certificate that, you know, specifies the exact route of the pipeline. That doesn't mean that the route isn't subject to change if FERC makes changes or approves changes, but there is encapsulated within the certificate the route of the pipeline. In order to effectuate the pipeline, then, the company needs to, who's now the certificate holder, needs to secure the rights of way for the pipeline. You know, generally those take the form of, you know, easements. It's not that there's a need to take the property in fee, but there is a need for an easement for the pipeline to go through the property. That process is often taken care of through voluntary negotiations. But in order to essentially deal with the holdout problem that inheres in any major public infrastructure project, you know, going back to the early turnpikes and canals, to solve that holdout problem, the pipeline certificate holder is clothed with the federal government's eminent domain power and has the power to initiate a proceeding to condemn the easement or the right of way and to pay just compensation to the property owner in, you know, compliance with the takings clause and its just compensation requirement. That's the way it's been set up for about 70 years under the Natural Gas Act. For about 70 years, both state property and private property has been taken by certificate holders pursuant to this process. Until very recently, that all went off without a hitch and without, you know, objection. You know, obviously, if you are the subject of an eminent domain proceeding, you're not particularly happy about it. But, you know, your solace is that the proceeding is designed to give you just compensation. And as I say, for roughly seven decades since this provision was added to the Natural Gas Act in 1947, this has gone off without a hitch. But New Jersey in these proceedings and, you know, Maryland has now followed suit in another case. And Oregon has promised that it will follow suit if allowed, have raised an 11th Amendment objection. And they essentially, you know, look past momentarily the fact that this is a very unusual proceeding, an eminent domain proceeding under a statute where you have essentially a company that is deputized with the federal eminent domain authority. But they look past that and say, at the end of the day, this is just a suit by a citizen corporate citizen, but a corporate citizen of Delaware against the state, and that's a no-no under the 11th Amendment. The district court made pretty short work of that argument and said, you know, you're kind of misunderstanding the basic point of eminent domain. The Third Circuit reversed, and essentially they ultimately ruled on statutory grounds, but the essence of the decision was to find sovereign immunity presence under these circumstances, and that case was taken up to the Supreme Court, and that's the case that was argued yesterday. I think, Roger, you have accurately captured the argument that it was wide-ranging, both substantively but also chronologically. You know, there was a fair amount of discussion about the plan of the convention. There was a fair amount of discussion about kind of what Congress wanted to do in 1947. There was also a fair amount of discussion about kind of the nature of an eminent domain suit. It's, you know, a very different suit from kind of your classic damages action against a state, which was the, you know, what precipitated the 11th Amendment in the form of Chisholm against Georgia. Unlike a typical in personam damages action, there's no threat to the Treasury. There's not even an allegation of wrongdoing. To the contrary, the idea of this kind of suit is you're essentially alleging that the state has been wronged in its capacity as property owner and is entitled to just compensation. And then maybe the last thing I'll leave you with, because I know you have plenty of questions for me, and this case is an interesting one that certainly raised plenty of questions on the justices' part. But one thing that is interesting is, you know, if you think about the state's ability to file a takings action, and the state very much reaffirmed yesterday that they think that if their property can be taken, they're entitled to a just compensation action under the takings clause. If you look at the text of the takings clause, it talks about private property. And, you know, one of the questions that Justice Barrett asked near the end of the argument was, isn't it a little unusual that the state, on the one hand, is saying that it has a right to just compensation because this is private property, but on the other hand, is saying that there is a sovereign injury with respect to the eminent domain action? So that's just one of the many kind of interesting questions that were kicked around yesterday.
Well, and there were quite a number of those questions, and I'd like to actually play justice here a little bit and ask about a few of those questions, Paul, and see what you think about them, not only from your client's perspective, but perhaps from the broader perspective of maybe give us a bit of the other side as well. There was mention by a number of the justices of the caption of the case, that the caption, and we're talking about the caption in the trial court, was PennEast Pipeline, which I believe was Justice Gorsuch said, yeah, now that's a citizen of Delaware, right, versus the state of New Jersey. And that looks like a suit by a citizen of one state against another state brought in federal court. Isn't that exactly what the 11th Amendment prohibits? Why isn't this case barred by the 11th Amendment?
So I'll definitely answer that in terms of kind of coming at it from both pieces of the caption. But I will start with the observation that the actual caption in the district court for all of these consolidated actions was, you know, PennEast Corp versus 1.92 acres of land, 1.07 acres of land, an easement for 1.25 acres of land. And so these cases were not filed principally in district court as PennEast versus New Jersey. Now, there's a rule of federal procedure that requires that you also list the at least one property owner for every parcel. But consistent with the fact that these are in rem actions, the principal defendant in every one of these actions is a piece of property. And, you know, if you're not familiar with in rem lawsuits, it's really weird. But if you kind of think back and, you know, maybe in the recesses of your mind, you can think back to some, you know, really catchy captions in Supreme Court history, like, you know, United States versus 50,000 acres of land, or even, you know, United States versus, you know, $600 in currency. You know, there are these in rem actions where the defendant is, I think, both substantively but also as a matter of form, is the property. And that was the case in these cases as well. And so one argument as to why the 11th Amendment's text isn't directly on point is that these are not suits against the state. These are suits against property in which the state has an ownership interest, but that's different from a suit against the state. And the Supreme Court, in a series of cases, including a case called Hood, written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, and another case called California against Deep Sea Research, I think it's called, drew that distinction and said that the 11th Amendment doesn't apply with its full force or by its terms to certain in rem actions. The second argument that the text of the 11th Amendment isn't satisfied here is, although at one level, Penn East is suing, you know, is a citizen of Delaware, its corporation incorporated in Delaware. In another way, that's not really the capacity in which it's suing. And it's suing under a particular statute that empowers a lawsuit only by a FERC certificate holder. And in that suit, they're really suing in the capacity as a federal delegee. And, you know, obviously that sounds a little abstract, I suppose. But one way in which I think it kind of buttresses that this is not a private corporation suing in its private capacity is that this is, you know, if Penn East in this lawsuit doesn't provide just compensation or, you know, were to try to take additional property for a non-public use, it would be violating the takings clause. And the reason it would be violating the takings clause, which, you know, by its terms doesn't apply to anybody but the federal government, is because for these purposes, it's a limited purpose federal actor. And so obviously one of the arguments we made is if Penn East is a limited purpose federal actor for purposes of the Fifth Amendment, it would make a lot of sense if they're also a limited purpose federal actor for purposes of the 11th Amendment, in which case they're not really suing as a citizen of Delaware.
So, Paul, I guess this raises at least two issues in my mind that are perhaps somewhat related. The one is, from the perspective of the property owner, whether this is private property or whether there's something different about a state-owned property, the owner certainly does have an interest in the proceeding, whether it be in rem or not, when it's their property involved. If the federal government comes in and condemns my house and excludes me, I have an interest both in whether this is for public purpose, that was the Kelo case, and whether I'm getting just compensation for it. And then kind of related to that, I'd like you to kind of address in a sense how this relates to the notion of property rights. And I guess related to that is you talked a lot about deputization or that this wasn't a delegation, but it was a limited federal actor. In essence, Penn East is acting as the federal government. And yet, in a federal condemnation, the party that files the lawsuit is the federal government. The lawyers that handle the lawsuit are lawyers from the Justice Department, the U.S. Attorney's Office. The funds are paid out of the federal treasury, and title goes to the federal government. Needless to say, in this case, it's a Penn East, a private actor, hiring its own lawyers, acting under the authority of Penn East, and it's Penn East that pays for the property, Penn East that gets the title. They don't look like the same thing, at least on their face.
So, Roger, let me try to be responsive to both of those points. You know, in terms of, you know, certainly if the, you know, any government, whether it's the federal government or the state government, tries to take your property, you know, you have an interest in those proceedings by virtue of your interest in the property. There's sort of no denying that. But the one thing that is critical about all of those proceedings, no matter, you know, which government initiates them, is, you know, it's not like a normal in personam suit where if, for example, you're outside the jurisdiction of the court, because, you know, you're not present in the jurisdiction, you can essentially block the lawsuit from going forward by virtue of kind of absenting yourself from the jurisdiction. The rule, you know, in the eminent domain context, and really I think in every in rem context, is because the principal focus of the lawsuit is the property, and because you need a certain amount of security as to who has the ultimate property interest in the property. Somebody cannot really sort of put the kibosh on either an eminent domain proceeding or other in rem proceeding by just kind of refusing to show up or refusing to accept process or absenting themselves from the jurisdiction. And that's kind of black letter law that goes back, you know, to the framing and makes sense. You know, if you have something where the reason it's the distinct litigation is you have to fix the ultimate, you know, rights in a particular race or property, you can't let sort of somebody's kind of process-based objection get in the way of that. And that's part of the reason that an immunity in this context, you know, really is a stranger in a strange land. There are others, and I'd be happy to elaborate, but that's just, you know, it's not to deny that there's not an interest in a property, but it's not the kind of interest that you can just sort of wish away the fact that, you know, that the sovereign is exercising its eminent domain authority and effectively veto it by absenting yourself or refusing to participate in the process. And that's effectively what the New Jersey claim of immunity would do. The second piece is, I mean, you're absolutely right that, you know, the federal government, when it takes the federal property itself, uses a different process. But I also think that it's worth keeping in mind that this is not some innovation that Congress came up with in 1947 in the Natural Gas Act. I mean, as long as the federal government has exercised eminent domain authority, it has used private deputies in this way. And that's a tradition that predates the founding, and other governments have used this process in the same way. And first of all, it makes a little practical sense. And you can go back to, this is the way that most of the railroads were built. And, you know, sometimes it was the federal government, sometimes it was the state government, depending on the era and the area. But in those cases, the government lent its eminent domain authority essentially to the railroad company with varying degrees of supervision at different parts of our history. But, you know, the government had a supervening interest in the railroad being built for infrastructure and commerce purposes, but they weren't particularly well situated to either be the ones that implemented the eminent domain and provided the compensation. It just made more practical sense for the railroad company that was going to derive some revenue from the infrastructure project once it was complete to be the one that did the ministerial acts of condemning the land and providing just compensation, and to be the ones that wrote the check. And like I said, this is, you know, it is a different way of implementing the eminent domain power, but it goes, its roots go all the way back to the beginning of the use of the eminent domain power. And then the second point I'll make, and this is what I think is, you know, really interesting for, you know, people, you know, kind of in the Federalist Society who, you know, have a vision of limited government, because, you know, it's sort of easy to, you know, not like the eminent domain power at all and not like when it's exercised, because it's the exercise of government power over private land. But in some respects, you know, a world where there is a robust eminent domain power, but only the government itself, or particularly the federal government itself, can exercise it, is not really a recipe for limited government. And, you know, I think it's an interesting thought experiment to go back and think about what the development of the railroads would have looked like if New Jersey's position was correct. Because, you know, if New Jersey's position is correct, then any state that didn't want a railroad could have objected to the building of the transcontinental railroads. And, you know, I suppose New Jersey would say, well, it's not that big a deal because the federal government could just do it itself. But then, you know, as a necessity of New Jersey's argument, you'd essentially have little federal land offices all throughout the, you know, the lower 48 as a result of this immunity. And it's that's not obviously something that might have been a net plus from the perspective of a limited federal government, that it would all of a sudden have to have, you know, this network of land offices to exercise the eminent domain power in a more hands-on way. So, I think that's one of the aspects of this that is very interesting and makes kind of New Jersey's argument. In a sense, it strikes me as kind of a federalism argument that, you know, only a blue state could love, because the net effect of it would be to make all governments larger, including the federal government, and have to do more things themselves and not have any kind of private-public partnership.
So, Paul, I think you've actually touched on one of the key issues that the court was interested in yesterday as well, and that is this so-called delegation or deputization, the lending of the federal power of eminent domain to private parties. Are there other areas in the functioning of our national government in which the federal government can hand over to private parties governmental authority and, in essence, vest them with the authority to, to do an Article 1 or an Article 3 or Article 2, I suppose, any of those functions? Where does this sort of come from? How do we get the idea that the sovereign can hand power to a private individual?
So, you know, Roger, I think this idea is less problematic if you do go all the way back to kind of the framing. Especially if you live in Washington, D.C., and you're surrounded by these big federal office buildings full of federal officers. You know, it seems like, you know, boy, you know, yeah, there's federal officers with a federal badge, and there's the citizenry, and there's like a high wall of separation, Thomas Jefferson might say, between the two. But if you go back to kind of, you know, the framing era, where there was very little machinery of the federal government, and you don't even have a Justice Department for the first 100 years of our nation, but you nonetheless had federal officers bringing lawsuits and the like in various capacities. I think it's just much easier to sort of get your head around the idea that there are certain federal functions where we're gonna rely on some otherwise private individuals to prosecute some of the federal government's lawsuits. To even, you know, I think if you go back all the way back to the framing era, this could happen. I don't know if it could happen in the federal government or not, but certainly at the state level, you could have even criminal prosecutions brought by private individuals who are kind of deputized as like a, you know, special AG. And, you know, in other contexts, you know, you have sort of, you know, privateers in a war context. So I do think that, you know, in present day terms, I don't think that, you know, there's as much of this. But, you know, if you're trying to understand what, you know, the kind of Constitution meant from the beginning, or from, you know, the 11th Amendment, I do think this idea of deputization or delegation is not as kind of unusual as we may think it is today. And I would really underscore that, you know, that the tradition in the eminent domain context in particular is really, you know, quite the roots of that run quite deep. I came across an 1888 treatise on eminent domain power that was kind of the state of the art treatise as of 1888. And in one place in passing, the author says, you know, the eminent domain power can even be exercised by the government itself. I mean, so you know, this is something where, you know, the delegation of this power is really more the rule than the exception historically. And I'm not sure there really are too many other things that are like that.
Great. Well, you know, I think this is the kind of case that could be the subject of an entire program all on its own for an afternoon. But unfortunately, time is fleeting, and I want to give our audience an opportunity to ask questions of Paul Clement. So, Evelyn, if we might, could we open the mic for the audience to ask questions.
Absolutely. We'll now open the floor for audience questions. While we're waiting for audience members to join the queue, I'll hand the floor back over to you, Roger.
Great. And I think, Paul, you know, some of the issues that might be of interest to folks would be in the field of property rights and private property ownership and their central position with respect to the citizens' position vis-a-vis the federal government. But I also thought after the argument yesterday, and I'd like your comment on this, that if indeed the action is really in rem and it doesn't matter who is the owner of the property particularly, and the state therefore cannot assert sovereign immunity, does it go the other way around? Can the state do an in rem action, institute an in rem action against property that belongs to the Park Service or the Forest Service, a federal agency, and make the same argument? It doesn't matter whether it's whether the federal government owns the property. It is nevertheless just an in rem action, and so federal immunity doesn't obtain there. What would you say to somebody out west who would make that argument?
And I think what I would say is, a Western state that has that in mind shouldn't get too excited, because, you know, I think the problem with that lawsuit would be less a sovereign immunity problem as such and more a supremacy clause problem at the end of the day. And, you know, that really gets to what, you know, I think is one of the critical flaws in the New Jersey position, as, you know, as it came to the court. And that is, and it's kind of an oddity of their position, but, you know, they did not take issue, and do not take issue with the authority of the federal government to take state property. So the taking itself, if it's by the federal government, is something that New Jersey concedes. And right there, that distinguishes it from the hypo where a state tried to take the federal government's property, because the federal government would not concede that, you know, that the taking is okay. So New Jersey's position is a little bit of an odd one, which is they don't claim sovereign immunity from the taking itself. They only claim sovereign immunity from the judicial process that's sort of necessary to effectuate the taking and provide just compensation. And the reason that I guess I think that's a little backwards, and it kind of leads to my sort of, you know, stranger in a strange land comment, is, you know, ultimately in our unique system of dual sovereignty, only one government can have the ultimate authority over land within the boundaries of state. Because if the rule were otherwise, you know, you could imagine a system where the federal government takes the state property and, you know, and take pennies out of it for these purposes of this illustration. It's just everybody's acting directly. But the federal government could take the state property through eminent domain, and then the state could say, we're going to exercise our eminent domain and take it right back. And, you know, and so on and so forth. So you can't have that kind of infinite loop. So something has to give. One sovereign power has to be superior. And New Jersey was perfectly willing to concede that it's the federal government's power that is superior. But once you concede that, it seems to me properly understood, you really do concede the whole case. Because the whole idea of eminent domain, as its name suggests, is that there's a sovereign that has the ultimate power and, in case of public necessity, can make a claim for every piece of property in the realm. And once that happens, like, there's no immunity from the judicial process to implement it. And, you know, if there were any immunity, it would stop the federal government from taking certain kinds of land. And there's a suggestion in an old case, for example, that the federal government couldn't take the land on which the state capital sits for 10th Amendment purposes. But that would be an immunity from the taking at all. But once you recognize that there's a different sovereign that has the ultimate authority to take title of the property from you, it's really hard to assert a sovereign immunity against that, because the eminent domain is like the ultimate act of the superior sovereign. And there's a strain of cases, this is called the immovable property exception to sovereign immunity, but there's a strain of cases that, you know, basically make that point, but also make an interesting point, which I have to say, I'm not sure I ever really thought about it in these terms before this case. But, the court in some of these cases has said pretty much flat out that property ownership is not an inherently sovereign act. And there's a way of thinking about this is, you know, the real interference with New Jersey's sovereignty in all of this is the fact that, you know, the federal government gets to pick the pipeline route. The federal government gets to pick a pipeline route even across state land. If the state doesn't want a pipeline, if the state has different environmental policies, different energy policies, the federal government gets to override all of that. And all of that that it's overriding is distinctly sovereign. When it comes to, you know, the property and the state's interest as a property owner, they're not distinctly sovereign. And let me just end this little riff with a point. I think, you know, Roger, and all the good work you've done in takings over the years, maybe you'd appreciate this point. But I think there's a sense in which, you know, one advantage of us winning this case is it would put the state of New Jersey in the position where occasionally the shoe is on the other foot and they have their property taken, which you might think might translate to them being a little bit more sympathetic to the claims of the property owner when New Jersey exercises its own eminent domain authority.
Well said. Evelyn. Do we have calls?
Yes, we do. We have one caller in the queue. And at this point, I'll hand the floor over to our first caller.
All right. This question is for Paul. What is the rationale for sovereign immunity? If the government is subject to the law, just like the citizens, why should the government be immune from suit except where it consents?
So it's a great question. You know, it goes, you know, all the way back, you know, well past the framing era to the conception of the king can do no wrong. And, you know, and then that got translated into, you know, the English system to the idea that, you know, kind of Parliament can do no wrong. Nobody thought that was actually true, but that was kind of the theory of it. And that created the reality where, you know, unless Parliament, sort of created an express cause of action against the government, that, you know, if the action took place, then there would be no kind of remedy for that at all. And, you know, that wasn't the world's most popular idea in general, but the one place it seemed uniquely unfair was when the sovereign took a private individual's land, because, you know, and this is a strain that goes through the court's takings cases, but, you know, the idea is like, if the government does something and it takes, you know, 1% of your income from everybody, well, nobody's happy about it, but at least it falls equally. But when the government wants to build, say, you know, a mill in, you know, a colonial town, and everybody's going to benefit from the mill, but, you know, certain people are going to have their property taken or the property flooded, it just seems fundamentally unfair not to give those individual property owners some kind of remedy. And, you know, that's kind of the origins of the takings clause. The idea that if the government is going to exercise its eminent domain power over particular pieces of property, it can't do so unless it provides just compensation. So you can almost think about the takings clause as being a forced waiver of sovereign immunity. And, you know, that's another reason why I think New Jersey's claim here is sort of a little bit backwards, because it is precisely because of the takings clause that the federal government couldn't just say, yeah, here's the pipeline route, and, you know, we're going to give the pipeline route to a company for a supervening public use, and that's going to be a bad thing for the property owners, but so be it. We really need to do it. The federal government can't do that, of course, because of the takings clause. But the takings clause, you know, unlike other constitutional provisions, which are just an absolute prohibition on certain conduct, it's really just saying, if you're going to do this, you must provide a remedy. And that's really what Congress was trying to do in this provision that New Jersey is taking issue with. But if you kind of take the long view of history, it's like New Jersey's objecting to its constitutional remedy, even though it's conceding the legitimacy of the underlying taking. And there's something just a little bit backwards about that. But it's a great question about the you know, the origins of sovereign immunity, because it, you know, it really does go back to this, you know, notion that the king can do no wrong. And, you know, that would certainly not be a popular notion on this side of the Atlantic, either in 1789, 1776, or today.
Evelyn, do we have anyone else?
At the moment, that was the only question in the queue, so I will hand the floor back over to you.
Great. Well, I think that Paul has been extremely gracious with his time today, particularly at a point where he is has undoubtedly spent a lot of time working on not only this argument, but all his other Supreme Court arguments this term. And I don't want to presume on your time anymore, Paul, but I would like to ask that you come back when you do get a decision in this case, so that we can discuss it again and just see how accurate your observations were today with respect to the issues of federalism and just compensation and takings law, 11th Amendment immunity, and the rest. Will you join us next June when the court finally decides this case?
I'd be happy to, Roger, and it's great to be with you, even over the telephone, and really appreciate your sort of thoughtful questions and thoughtful commentary on the argument yesterday.
Thank you, everyone. And with that, I think we will draw this program to a close.
Wonderful.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for calling in and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming Teleforum calls and virtual events. And we do have another Teleforum coming up this afternoon at 3:30, I believe. So check your emails for an announcement on that. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.